Welcome to another edition of Mormon Land. I'm managing editor Dave Noyce, and I oversee our faith coverage. I'm joined again by senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
Well, women are gaining a higher profile in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at both the local and general levels. But being in the room, and usually vastly outnumbered by men when issues are discussed and decisions are made, often by the faith's all-male priesthood, doesn't necessarily mean these women are being heard, let alone heeded. New research from three Brigham Young University professors, Olga Stoddard, Jessica Priest, and Chris Karpowitz, sheds light on group gender dynamics. Two of those researchers, Jessica Priest and Chris Karpowitz, join us today via Zoom to discuss their findings and how women's voices and views can be elevated, not only in business, government, politics, and academia, but also in the LDS Church. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. Jessica, maybe we could start with you and you could briefly explain how you conducted the study.
Sure. So several years ago, we approached an accounting program and talked with them a little bit about the teams that they put their students in to take classes together, study together, do assignments together. And these teams are meant to mimic the way that lots of work is done in the real world, on, you know, not just accounting teams, but all sorts of teams in management and you know, all across the business sector. And so we talked with them a little bit about the way that they put students into these teams. And historically, what they had done is they had sort of spread the women out among the various different groups to try and make sure that as many groups as possible had a woman, right? Or maybe women, you know, in them. And so, you know, we talked a little bit about some research that Chris has done in the laboratory about the challenges that happen when women are distinctly outnumbered in teams of deliberation. And so they said, we'd love to work with you. We'd love to work with you to organize these groups and compare the way that we have been doing it with these sort of like one woman in a group of five to some teams that are majority women. And so that was the beginning of a really fantastic multi-year partnership.
So tell us, Jessica, I mean, we're going to talk about a lot of the findings, but what are some key findings you discovered through this?
Well, probably the best way to describe the key findings is to let you know that we had planned on doing this study for 3 years. And at the end of the second year, as we were presenting some preliminary results, the program said, you know what, we're not going to be putting women by themselves anymore. And so, you know, so the data you have is the data you have. And we felt like that was probably the right call. The being a lone woman is not, it's not a great place to be. It's not, you know, there are lots of things that are just fine about it, but there's some ways in which women have a hard time building authority in these groups where they're the token or the lone woman.
Yeah, if I could just jump in there, I think that and the findings that we discovered with the accounting program paralleled very closely the types of findings that I had been seeing in the lab in previous studies and that we had seen in other political settings like school boards. So one of the nice things about school boards is there's actually variation in the gender composition of boards across the country. And so when we looked at boards with very few women, we found that they were commenting less. They seemed to have more trouble generating authority. By authority, what we mean is the expectation of influence. That is that when other people, when you talk, other people listen, and they might not agree with everything you're saying all the time. That's not a sign, necessarily a sign of good deliberation if everyone always agrees all the time. And but we do want members of decision-making groups to listen to each other, and we want everyone's perspectives to be fully heard by the other members of the group. And so that's really the kind of thing that Jessica and I were interested in too. And we found that it was very challenging, even for extraordinarily accomplished women in this accounting program we were studying, to generate authority when they were outnumbered by men.
That's fascinating to me in the fact that they're, it's not a question of qualifications. A matter of fact, sometimes they're better qualified. And the other members of the group knew that they were qualified, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the accounting groups that we looked at, for example, the women and the men came into the groups with the same GPAs in terms of previous leadership experience, like being involved in high school government. The women were actually more accomplished than the men. And so despite those equalities of performance and even advantages in some sense for women in previous leadership experience, they were having trouble generating authority or being granted authority by the other members of the group.
Yeah, I mean, it's an admission only program. So everybody that's there applied, and everybody knows that everybody worked really hard to get there. So these are really talented and impressive women that we're talking about.
So to what did you attribute this? Simply gender?
Well, that's a really good question, because I think we should probably make it really clear that there's a lot going on, right? There are many different factors that influence who has authority in a group. But the specific way that we did this study was targeted to try to understand what the consequences are of the gender composition of the group. And so it's a randomized controlled trial. Think about like a drug trial where you have some people take a placebo pill and other people take the actual drug, and then you can compare the outcomes between the two groups to see if the drug works better than the placebo. So that's sort of the idea here. And so, you know, we randomly assigned people to these lone women groups or majority women groups. There were also some all male groups. And so the thing that we're able scientifically to really isolate is, you know, on average, these two sets of groups are identical to each other, right? Because they've been randomly assigned to one group or the other. So the only, like on average, the only difference in the experience that these people are having is how many women and men are in their groups. And so that's the thing that we're able to sort of like scientifically talk about in this particular case is gender. And there are, of course, other factors, but that's what we designed this study to study.
And there's variation within genders, you know. So we're looking at the effects of gender composition, and men and women do differ from each other, but there's variance among women and among men. And so even when we account for all of that, all of those potential differences, what we see is some really striking patterns as we compare these groups with very few women to groups with a majority of women. And as I say, we've seen that not just in this study, but in a series of studies that we've done and in observational work in places like the school boards that I was mentioning before.
So do you think women and men are socialized to not give women authority or not to listen to a lone woman, or how did this happen?
That's a great question. And certainly processes of socialization matter a great deal in these sorts of dynamics. It's not the case that women don't have anything to say or aren't able to have authority, right? Because we see those differences across the conditions. It has to do with sets of expectations that we have. Much of the work that we've done has to do with political contexts. And there, politics, for example, is often seen as a kind of a man's game, or has been in the past. And certainly there are implications of that So I definitely think that processes of socialization matter here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we find, we find some differences, some small differences in how much men and women speak in the deliberations. Like in the lone women groups, women speak a little less than they do in the three women groups. I guess all of this is just to say, we see women, sometimes there's this advice to like lean in, right? Like if you just show up and if you just make sure that you have a seat at the table and if you just speak up and say your mind and add your expertise and what we find is it's just not enough when you're outnumbered, right? That it does work. It works when there's in these majority women groups that the women who participate more have more authority. But in those lone women groups, like it doesn't matter how much you speak up and it doesn't matter how good you are at the task, right? Like those things don't. And in fact, the better you are in this particular setting, the better you are at the task, the less likely you are to get authority for the women's.
That was one of our more disturbing
thoughts. Wow, that is.
It's very disturbing. So it's not just that women aren't participating, right? It's that there's something in the air, right? There's something in the socialization. There's something in the norms of how we interact with each other in a male-dominated setting that just make it really hard for women to be taken seriously.
And I think this idea of norms is really important, right? What are both the formal and the informal practices that groups have together? And those are particularly important because, as Jessica says, it's not just a matter of individual effort, right? These are incredible. In our accounting study, these were incredibly accomplished women who were leaning in. They were trying to participate, and they were still having this reaction, or they were still struggling to be as influential as women are in other settings. And so, paying attention to the things that we actually can control as a group, not just as individuals, not just saying you individual need to try harder or do more, but we can also pay attention to the aspects of the group over which we have control. We think that's a very, very important part of helping all perspectives to be heard fully.
So how do you see these findings could potentially be applied to the LDS Church, a place where the top leaders are all men and ward congregational leaders are all men? But there have been, as Dave said in his intro, changes in ward councils and things like that. How do you see these findings being applied, if at all?
So I think that's a really great question. The setting in which we're studying things has been academics and business and politics. And so we don't have sort of real great data on how this might apply in a religious setting. Some things are similar, some things are different. But I think a point that Chris just made is really important. There are certain things that in an LDS congregation you have control over and certain things you don't have control over, right? And so a congregation doesn't have control over the sex of the bishop, right? Or the sex of the elders' quorum president. Those are just not things that are within the control of anybody who wants to, change things in their ward. But there are things that you do have control over. So when you have a ward council, right, who gets invited, right? There are the people who are supposed to be at ward council, but then the handbook also says you can invite other people as needed, right? So who gets invited to ward councils? And then, of course, how those ward councils operate is you know, there's so much flexibility and a lot of variation in how that, how those councils play out, and not just ward councils, but any kinds of calling, deliberations in various callings, as the Sunday school people meet together or whatever, you know. So we think that there are lots of opportunities for people to be thinking about what do we have control over here, and we have control over norms, right? We have some control over who's in the room. Chris, did you want to follow up on that?
No, I think that's, I think what you said is perfect, Jessica. In some of my other research, we varied some other aspects of the group. So for example, we varied the decision rule that the group followed. And we found that in groups that were asked to decide, to make decisions together using principles of consensus or unanimity, had very different dynamics, and that just changing the decision rule, even when women were outnumbered, really helped the women to be seen as more influential and to participate more. And that's important because we have control over that. And in fact, the handbook of the LDS Church says that ward councils ought to try to seek for unity and to counsel together until everyone's on the same page. That's actually very consistent with the research that I've done in terms of trying to help everyone be heard fully. It, from a deliberative perspective, we really need everybody's perspective to be on the table. That doesn't mean they're all going to be the same perspectives or that it's easy to get to consensus. One of the challenges of unanimity rule or consensus rules is that it takes longer to get to decisions. And so there are downsides or difficulties or challenges that are associated with that. But if what your goal is, if your goal is to hear from everyone, to make sure everybody's perspective is included in the decision making, and really that's one of the important reasons for having councils, then reasoning together, talking together, and seeking for consensus and unanimity can be a very powerful goal. But if the goal is just to ratify what the person conducting the meeting already thought to begin with, then, you know, that's a different kind of meeting and a different sort of goal and a different sort of dynamic.
It's not really a council then, I suppose, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, it seems like if I'm LDS bishop, mm-hmm. taking away from your research, and you know, like you say, it may play out differently in a religious setting. One thing I would want to make sure is that, number one, I increase the number of women there.
Yeah.
Because you're saying it almost doesn't matter, you know, how influential or the input, you know, the women in the minority might give. You're going to want to have more women there for starters.
If bishops are able to do that, then that is likely to help women's voices be heard and to be seen as more influential within the council. And so I think, as Jessica indicates, there is some flexibility on that, and that would be a really important thing.
You know, one of my favorite things about spending many years in a singles ward is that singles ward bishops, in my experience, are sometimes more creative in thinking about how to approach councils and callings and adapt to the needs of their particular congregation. And so, it's always been interesting to me when people say, "Oh, well, we can't do X, Y, or Z," and I'm like, "Well, actually, it doesn't say that in the handbook." And you know, I had a bishop that did A, B, and C, and so to me, that sort of the necessity being the mother of invention in singles wards has given me a lot of opportunity to see how creative a bishop can actually get.
And I would add just one other thing to that, which is that one of the challenges that I think we can sometimes have in a ward council. I had a really smart honors student interview men and women about their experiences in ward councils a few years ago, and she had a really interesting experience doing that study. And one of the things that occurs is that women sometimes feel like, well, men have been in the ward council, some of these men, all their lives. And so they're much more comfortable in that setting. And so the more we can do to help women be comfortable in this setting and to feel like it's okay to speak up and to be heard and to help men to listen, those are all good things that can be done. And so just the experience of being there repeatedly can matter.
I have actually talked to a woman in the Boston area who got herself pushed and got herself invited to bishopric meetings every week or whatever, however they did. And that kind of follows your model of just one woman and all the rest were men. And she found that it was pretty good, but she also found that things were happening. Decisions were being made that somehow she wasn't involved in it, even though she was at the meeting.
Right.
And she said that she discovered there was an email that went out to the other men, but not to her. So callings were decided that way and stuff. But what I hear you saying is from your research that even if there was just one woman, if they had used that unanimity model that you talk about, mm-hmm. that might have given her more quote, power or authority to, I mean, and just like in your research, she said there was no ill intent on the part of the leaders. They did
right.
not mean to exclude her. They were not mean or harsh, but they were really unaware of how they were interacting with one another. So I can totally see how just one woman wouldn't make such a difference, even though she was very strong. But if they change the model, that could include, could enhance power.
Yeah.
Jessica, do you think that's...
Yeah, so I think I have two thoughts about this. I'm hoping I can remember both of them. but the first is this, it really does, it's a choice that local church leaders have to make. And it's going to take conscious effort because socialization is, we're just going to get this done with our friends and just, you know, knock these callings out, right? But if you notice, I mean, one of my favorite things to talk about is Elder Ballard has been harping on this for decades, literally decades. He has been giving conference talks and writing a book, right? Counseling with our councils about how to effectively lead a council meeting. And it is not, we just try and get things done as fast as possible and the bishop has ideas and we just sort of ratify. I mean, that is, his 1994 talk, Counseling with Our Councils, is harsh in its language for leaders who choose to do that way. He specifically says, you are living below the potential of your ward. And he said, you know, if you actually used all of the talents of everyone in your council, what could you be doing? You could be, you know, feeding the hungry in your community. You could be helping orphans. You could be solving crime, right? He has this like very extensive list of things that could be done if councils chose to operate in this more deliberative kind of way. So that's the first thing that I would say. The second thing I would say is it's a really natural tendency to be around and to want to make decisions with people who are a lot like you. We call it homophily in social science. And so, you know, the fact that there's a sort of an other text chain or email chain or whatever. It's the old boys club that people don't realize they're being the old boys club, right? Because they're just trying to solve problems and do things efficiently with their friends and you know, and so that's a really common scenario when decisions kind of get made outside of the formal decision-making process And that's the old boys club, but you often don't realize that you're doing the old boys club thing.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I certainly think Elder Ballard's work is actually full of marvelous advice for councils, and bishops would do well to listen carefully to what he is saying. And I think the signals that people who are formally given authority to lead a meeting send are really quite important, right? And so is the bishop seeking for all of those different perspectives? Is he open to hearing something that might be different than what the people he knows best in the ward would say, right? If we're to truly harness the full power of a council, then we're going to need to hear from perspectives that have been heard less often in those councils to this point. And so I think that's incredibly important advice. And bishops can pay attention to things like seeking consensus and unity, but they can also seek to hear everyone in other ways as well. For example, paying attention to who speaks first. If you ask a question and it's always the elders quorum president who responds first and kind of sets the agenda for the discussion, then maybe you want to spread that around a little. Or maybe the bishop can do other things to make sure if there's somebody who hasn't been heard, that they're specifically invited to say a little more. And then the way not just the bishop, but everyone else in the council responds, right? Even if there are disagreements, if they can respond in ways that indicate care and respect for the person as you're talking about different perspectives, those are all really important signals to send.
What about, and maybe for both of you, Chris and Jessica, what about when conflicts happen? Are men more eager to embrace conflict than women and not get scared away from it? I'm just curious what the research shows.
Yeah, so one of the things we thought in my previous research that might be driving some of this is conflict aversion, that women would just be more conflict averse than men. And that's true as a generality, but we didn't find that conflict aversion was really the thing that was driving it. Now, one thing that is quite important is an individual sense of confidence, but as Jessica says, it's more than just asking people to lean in and be confident. It's about the kinds of reactions that people get. And so finding ways as a council to disagree productively is really important. And that's a hard thing to do in Mormon culture, right? Because we often feel really uncomfortable with that. But we're not talking about contention and being disagreeable, but we are talking about the idea that we have different perspectives and different life experiences, and it's important to hear from all of those, and they're not always going to lead us in the same direction. And sometimes what's really needed from the ward is to figure out how we piece those really different perspectives together.
The other thing that I would just add is, and I don't have a ton of specific research to back this up, but I think it's consistent with other things that we found, which is that a lot of the willingness to speak up when you have a differing opinion is based on how you think people are going to respond, right? And so if you think, oh, I could say this, but no one, you know, it's not going to matter, right? Then you're just going to say, sure, that sounds great, you know, yes, let's have that be the ward party, you know. and so I think, you know, they're separate processes here, they're related, but one process to think about is not just like what decision gets made at the end of the day, like that's important, but also like what is the process that happens when people have conflicting information, right? Do we say, oh, that's interesting, tell me more about that, right? Or, oh, that's so different than my experience, like, what, tell me more, right? That is the kind of reaction that is going to encourage people to continue to bring relevant information up, right? Whereas the kind of reaction that's like, oh, that's weird, I've never felt that before, right?
We've never done it like that before.
Yeah.
Right, that's the thing that's gonna just shut, people are just gonna start saying, you know, why even bother, right? And that process is entirely separate. It's a parallel thing to what decision gets made at the end of the day.
Right? Yeah, and I would say two things just in support of what Jessica just said, which is just so important, right? One is these kinds of dynamics are not unique to the church. So if you read Madeleine Albright's biography, for example, she talks about having some of these same types of experiences in governing councils around in the United States and around the world. And so we shouldn't think that this is unique. But second, Jessica described sort of the signals that we send to each other, and they're so important. In some other work that I've done, we looked at interruptions, and interruptions can be both speaker affirming and speaker disaffirming. That is, you can have an interruption that sort of says, oh yeah, that's interesting. Jessica would say, you know, I'd like to hear more about that, where you're technically interrupting, but you're doing it in a way that helps the speaker know you're engaged, you're listening, you want to know more, even if you don't necessarily agree with all of it. There's also a negative sort of interruption where you're kind of sapping the authority of the speaker and you're stealing the floor from the speaker in a way that really undermines them. And one of the things we found is that women are, as a general rule, are very sensitive to those signals, often a lot more than men are. And having a dynamic in which the group rapport is supportive, again, that's different from always agreeing with each other, but a dynamic in which there's a sense of support and trust and goodwill toward each other is really quite critical for hearing from everybody fully.
We talk a lot about, I guess, talking time, I think you refer to, making sure women have time to talk and to exert influence and authority. And one of the big times in Mormon culture is General Conference, where there are strings of men speaking and scattered here and there four or five women speakers. Would it be more beneficial to boost women's influence and authority and in the view of the membership if more women spoke at General Conference?
I mean, I can say I think it would, we could do better even with how we listen to the women who do speak. Right. I mean, there are all these jokes about, oh, it's time to go get the snacks. The primary president is about to speak in her primary voice. Right. And that kind of attitude, you know, again, that's the kind of thing that we have control over. Right. We have control over how we talk about the women who are in authority. Right. And we can talk to our children, to our families, on our Facebook posts in ways that that affirm their wisdom and their insights. We can assign their talks in Sundays or, you know, Elders Quorum and Relief Society for lessons. We can quote them in our sacrament meeting talks, right? We can study them in FHE, or we can ignore them and we can go get snacks and we can, you know, and we can be weirded out when they talk about things that aren't just, you know, about the primary or young women's or whatever their specific topic is. And so, you know, again, I think there's this idea of like what we have control over and what we don't have control over. And what we have control over is our reaction to the women who speak.
Yeah. And I think what Jessica says is so wise, and that the signals we send in how we talk to our family members about them. And this is very true of ward council members as well, right? Just the titles we use to talk about each other, right? If the elders quorum president is always president so-and-so and the relief society president is Sally or sister so-and-so, then that indicates something, right? And we can call the relief society president, and that's okay, right? And listening to the speakers we are getting in general conference carefully, listening to their messages. And as Jessica says, not just assuming that the young women's president's message is only for young women is incredibly important, right? Can we assign it and talk about her message in ways that get us to think about the ideas that she's articulating and the spiritual insights that she has to share? Those can be valuable to all of us. Part of what we see in ward councils, at least my student who did her interviews in ward councils, was that women sometimes felt that if they weren't talking about the primary, they weren't supposed to speak up. The primary president might feel that, right? But in fact, a council is meant to be a council to make collective decisions together. And yes, there are things that are unique to the primary that need to be articulated, but you know, the elders quorum president often doesn't limit himself to just the elders quorum. And so if everyone is thinking we are a part of a ward community and we're making collective decisions together, that's a really important perspective to make ward council more effective for everybody.
Can I add just one other? Oh, go ahead, Peggy.
No, I was going to ask a different question.
So one thing that I think is interesting thing to me is, you know, when we go to conference, a lot of what we hear are stories, right? We hear stories of faith. We hear stories of trials. We hear stories of overcoming or stories of sadness or stories of help, right? And those stories are rooted in personal experiences. And you know, and some of our leaders are sort of, you know, we know President Uchtdorf, Elder Uchtdorf is going to tell a story that involves airplanes, right? And we have acculturated ourselves to expect that and to respect that airplanes have something to tell us about the gospel, right? And that's wonderful. And I think one thing that I would like to see is I would like to see us pay the same kind of respect to experiences that women more commonly have. Right. So that, you know, sometimes when a woman starts telling a story about raising children or being pregnant or something like that, it's like, oh, this is the woman's stuff. Right? You know, I can kind of turn my brain off because this doesn't apply to me. Right. And, you know, if all of us can find value in stories of airplanes or stories of pickling or, you know, stories of hiking or farming, right? We can find value and lessons for all of us in quote unquote more feminine kinds of stories. And that's something that I would love to see us embrace more as a church culture for general conference, but also in sacrament meeting talks and other kinds of things, that we bring our experiences to the table. And those experiences are diverse and often they're a little bit different by gender. And we need to stop thinking that the lady stories are applied to women. The men's stories apply to everybody. Right? We need to be able to learn from those kinds of stories.
I think that's part of what it means to be in the body of Christ, right? That we have these different experiences, we have these different perspectives, and they all contribute to the collective community, the religious community that we're trying to build.
So I wanted to go back for a minute to Elder Ballard and his effort toward push Latter-day Saints towards councils. Elder Ballard was totally schooled by three women who were in the Relief Society presidency at the time. That was Elaine Jack, Aline Clyde, and Chieko Okazaki, a very powerful triumvirate. And he learned everything he knew about it from them. And I just wondered, so that goes to your research, which is they were really unified in talking about that. The three of them formed a very strong collaborative unit. Now we have in the past, I've reported this in the past 5 years or so, one woman was added to each of the executive priesthood councils, a presidency in each. But it sounds like from your research, maybe it would be better if a threesome were meeting with a threesome or something like that. You know, some way that those really strong women's voices could support one another and build, as opposed to just one woman on each of those committees. What do you think your research would bear that out?
Well, I mean, our research doesn't say anything about any particular, you know, right, religious committee or even church committees generally. But my student who did the interviews with ward councils, in talking to women, one of the things she found was that women took a great deal of comfort and courage from being with other women in the council experience, that it was helpful as more women were invited into the meeting, that was helpful to them. And certainly our research has said that groups with a lone woman are likely to have some dysfunctions when it comes to hearing from everyone fully, and certainly when it comes to women's sense of authority within those groups. And so, again, we're not speaking to any particular group with this research, but our findings are that there are various ways to highlight women's voices and perspectives and authority. And one of those is to increase the number of women in the group. And if that's not possible, then attending really carefully to the other things we've been talking about, the decision rule, the other kinds of signals that groups send, the kinds of signals that the person conducting or leading the meeting sends, those are all going to be critically important as well.
Yeah, there are multiple ways to address this. One of them is mechanical, just put more women. And another is to attend to things like norms and where leaders in meetings need to just be really conscious of this and do things differently, right? Sometimes this means we have to do things differently, and that's uncomfortable. And so, you know, it can take some time and effort, but
changing norms is by definition going to mean a little bit of discomfort and a little bit of getting used to doing things in a slightly different way. But, you know, sometimes that's the best way if what you want is to hear from everyone. If revelation has been sprinkled throughout the council and the only way to get to the right decision is to hear all of those pieces, those bits of revelation that are sprinkled throughout the council, then if somebody's not speaking up or is hesitant or is shut down the first time she tries to speak up, then we're not going to hear everything that we need to hear in order to make the decision the right way.
We're all experiencing how changing norms is uncomfortable right now, exactly. I suppose, right? So,
I don't know. I've been a lot more comfortable lately in my sweatpants, right?
There are some advantages. That's right. Yeah. I think the BYU Magazine article about your study talked about the influence in the home. I mean, a lot of these things are learned, you know, these mm-hmm. societal norms that kind of get in the way. So what's your advice to parents, for instance, in helping to raise boys and girls who can get the most out of these kind of dynamics, these gender groups and dynamics?
I would just say the first thing is you nailed it. It has to be for boys and girls. This is not a problem that's solved by just telling women that they can do anything they want, right? In fact, we looked at, in our study, we looked at how often women voted for themselves as the most influential person. And that was not what was driving these results. It was not the case that the lone women were less likely to vote for themselves, right? This is coming from outside perceptions, right? And so you can't solve it just by addressing girls. You have to train boys as well. And the other thing that I would just say, I'm not a parent, so I'll leave most of this to Chris to describe. But the other thing I would just say is, this is everywhere, right? Like the socialization comes from media. It comes from familial interactions. It comes from our own imperfect behavior that if we just sort of let that go without saying, oh, I just interrupted. We can make mistakes. We just have to acknowledge and explain that, you know, and so I think there's this idea that, you know, that sexism comes from like one source, right? Or you'll say, oh, well, the Mormon church is sexist, right? And that if we just, you know, everything is sexist, right? Like this is everywhere, right? And so it has to be a conscious effort on multiple fronts by parents. And it probably can't just be implicit. You probably are going to have to be explicit about it if you actually want your children to live in and operate in a world that's different than the one we currently have.
Yeah, I would just underscore a couple of things that Jessica said. One is, I think we should be very wary in church settings of importing wrong-headed ideas, sexist ideas about men and women into our church decision-making, right? That often the ideas we get are not from religious sources, they're imported from wrong-headed sources. And so we should be very wary of that, of the kinds of assumptions we make about men and women, because ultimately one of the core religious teachings within the church is that both men and women are children of God and have unique and infinite worth. And if we really believe that, right, then we're going to behave a little bit different than the world does on a whole host of things. Second, I would say there's no substitute for practicing these things at home. My father is a clinical psychologist, and so we had more opportunities than most to have family councils. And I learned this when I got married. Like I thought, we always have family councils about everything. And my wife was like, what? Why do we need to have a family council about this? But practicing these skills of making decisions collectively and doing that together is really important. And the signals that mothers and fathers send about each other and about their interactions with their sons and their daughters are going to be really important.
Can I just add, I think there's this sense that these kinds of things are adult issues, right? Or that are adult problems. But like so many things, if you sort of like wait to interact with your children in this certain kind of way until they're adults, it's like way too late, right? And so treating your children with respect, right? Treating them in the ways that you want them to be treated by other people. You want them to treat people when they're an adult, right? Like children are important and they have insights and you know, out of the mouth of babes, right? And so not thinking that this is only about how adults interact with each other, but also it's about how adults act with children and treating children with the kind of respect that we want them to get used to expecting, right? I think that's really important, because if they don't have any practice being treated with that kind of respect, they're not going to recognize it or know when something's wrong as an adult, right? So I think that's a really important thing. It's not just about how adults interact with each other. It's also how we treat our children.
And practice listening to each other, right?
Yeah.
And that's one of the core the core aspects of a good, of a well-functioning decision-making group is each member of the group actually does listen to what the other person is saying and doesn't just, isn't just waiting to make their next point, but is trying to listen and incorporate the perspectives that they're hearing from others.
Well, speaking as the baby in my family, I would have loved the unanimous rule growing up. Jessica,
what are we having for dinner tonight?
That's right. Exactly. Jessica Priest, Chris Karpowitz, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And stay safe out there, okay?
Will do.
Thank you.
And thanks to Peggy Fletcher Stack.
Always a pleasure.
And to our trusty producer, Chris Samuels. We remind our listeners that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to our free weekly newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next time on Mormon Life.